It is 5:31 and a half, so we'll start. Neil Masgrave, I can't think of anyone better to give a guest lecture on knowledge into action, because he knows an awful lot about knowledge into action. I'm going to resist telling all sorts of anecdotes about Neil. He's a medical doctor,
yeah.
But he works right across the board, and he's a real thinker outside the box, and I collect people who think outside the box, and that's the main reason I brought him in, not because he's a very clever professor, which he is, but because he is going to encourage us to think outside the box tonight. You can fill in the gaps that I haven't said about you and what the relevant things you think they need to know before you get into this amazing lecture, which I've seen twice before and I'm looking forward to seeing again.
Yeah, thanks, Trish. I think I've got a microphone on here. Are we okay? Can you hear me?
No.
Yeah, great. Okay. Well, thank you for the invitation. I'm going to whiz through about 4 days of stuff. Perhaps if I just stand at this side for at least for the moment, in about an hour. So I'm not going to fill in any more gaps about me, because it's more about how we go about making decisions. So what would be really great would be if you could dig out a piece of paper and a pen. If anybody needs any paper, here's some paper. Pass it backwards. This isn't going to be hard stuff. I know some of you have been working incredibly hard on this course this week, and it's day 4 and 5:30 at night. So this is going to be more on the entertainment end of things than on the education end of things, but I hope you'll find it interesting. I hope there's a few things to think about. It's just more fun if you join in, so be prepared for a bit of interactivity rather than just PowerPoint and me talking. So let's start with familiar territory. Here's the Sackett definition from 1996. I think this is heading for 30,000 citations. So there must be something in it now. I came here in 1994 when Dave Sackett was still here. We had a party at Martin Dore's house with a swimming pool, I remember. That was the greatest thing. No, it wasn't. Paul Glaziou was here and it was his first time as a group tutor, so it was that long ago. The point about this definition is that evidence-based medicine started out all about making decisions for individual patients, interestingly enough. It's my emphasis in red, but this was the task set was better decision-making for individuals, interestingly enough. Did we answer that question? Well, three bits in the prologue. So we were trying to drop in to the traditional clinical expertise alongside what would the patient consent to, even if we didn't do a tremendous amount at that time about getting values and preferences explicitly in the way that we might try and do nowadays, and we try and drop in this evidence. The task was to do that better, to have better consultations. That was the challenge from that EBM editorial from 1996. Did we answer that? Well, I'll steal this analogy from Don Berwick. This is a bridge in Honduras. Honduras is that little country in Central America. They get a lot of rain in Honduras. There are lots of rivers. And in the 1930s, they needed to build bridges because canoes weren't really cutting it for the economy. And they built this bridge, and the bridge was fantastic. It stood up to all sorts of weather. The traffic went backwards and forwards every day. Until in 1998, they got a Category 5 hurricane smack on the nose of Honduras. One of the worst hurricanes there's ever been on the planet. And this is the serious bit, it was absolutely awful. Tens of thousands of people died. Hundreds of thousands made homeless. The economy was decimated for a decade, but the bridge stood. The civil engineers had done a fantastic job. The There wasn't any malpractice in the construction. The bridge stood up to Hurricane Mitch. The only problem was the river moved. So the bridge answered the first problem. Now we've got a different problem, and we need to look again at what the challenge is. And one of the first things the evidence-based medicine movement did was start collecting all this fantastic research, or some of it was fantastic and some of it wasn't very good, and collecting it together into evidence summaries, some of which were called guidelines. And some were done very well, some were done okay-ish, and some weren't done very well at all. But instead of answering the complex question of how do we do consultations which incorporate those three elements, what we did was answer a simpler question, which was how do we collect the evidence together into evidence summaries and guidelines? And we did that quite a lot. So we're now over 230 guidelines at NICE, where I used to work. And we've developed a different problem now. We have guideline overload and information overload, and all of this is based upon what's best for the population, not what works best for the individual at this moment in time sitting in front of us with their clinical problem today. So that's prologue bit number one. Prologue bit number two features this famous American ice skater called Dorothy Hamill. Dorothy Hamill is advertising a drug called Roficoxib. Roficoxib was a sort of designer non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, which was produced in the hope of reducing one of the major side effects of all non-steroidals, and that is gastric ulceration and bleeding. And indeed, the original research that was published showed that there was a reduction in the rate of GI complications with Roficoxib compared to competitors. There was also a signal in the major randomized controlled trial that it might increase cardiovascular events by a small but absolute amount. So the advertising budget in the States, where they have direct-to-consumer advertising, was bigger than Budweiser or Pepsi, advertising $160 million on television largely, and people were going to their doctors and saying, can I have this new drug called Roficoxib? But they stopped doing that when the makers withdrew Roficoxib from the market because it increased the rate of cardiovascular events. Anybody have a guess at how many premature or avoidable cardiovascular events were estimated to have occurred in the United States associated with Roficoxib? What do you think? 100,000? High or low? Higher? About 140,000 to 160,000 with a 40% mortality rate. This was jumbo jets crashing. A phenomenal thing. The toll in the UK is estimated to be much less than that, but still a couple of thousand. And in my time at the National Prescribing Centre, we wrote a summary which said, use these things cautiously. There might be a little bit of a signal here. I'm not claiming that we did anything. But the context is that. And of course, with that, people started to look at the more traditional NSAIDs, particularly an NSAID called diclofenac. Diclofenac has a molecular structure very similar to Roficoxib. It has a COX-2 selectivity identical to Roficoxib. And this is the prescribing of diclofenac. So as this work's being analysed, almost half of all the prescriptions written by every GP in England for an NSAID was diclofenac. This is 05-06 here, this is 2013 over here. This line one is the time when the systematic review was published in the British Medical Journal saying diclofenac increased cardiovascular events by 3 per thousand per year. You might want to think about your prescribing, as does apparently, the evidence isn't fantastic, as it does with other NSAIDs, apart from ibuprofen and naproxen. Ibuprofen at standard doses, naproxen at 1,000 milligrams a day, doesn't appear to increase the cardiovascular rate. Note the dramatic effect, friends, on the prescribing of diclofenac once that signal is published in one of the world's leading scientific journals. And line two is where every prescriber gets a letter from the MHRA, the UK drugs regulator, saying you might want to think about your prescribing of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and think about using ibuprofen and naproxen rather than things like diclofenac. This is the point at which me and mine wound up prescribing advisors to go about talking to people in their GP practices and in their local groups. Note how long it takes for things to start dwindling downwards in terms of the use of diclofenac, and note the fact that northeast bit of England gets the message quite early and leads the pack. The West Midlands thinks about it for a bit and comes down quite nicely. Southeast coast does almost nothing for about 3 years and then starts to get hold of it. What do you think happened at point four? Time point four?
A lawsuit.
No, actually. We started having quaff points for prescribing, so GPs got money for doing the right thing. And at point five, the money got taken away. So it's a bit, you look at that sort of data and you think, these people aren't very bright, are they? Don't you think? I mean, isn't that the natural reaction? These people are, you know, pretty uncaring and they're not committed, they're not working hard enough at doing the right thing for their patients. You look at that prescribing data and you think, these people need a good slap. But of course, I'll do it one more time. It's great, isn't it? But of course, that's not the case. It's just a bit more complicated than telling people what to do. Changing what you do is particularly difficult. And we've, in the last 12 months, had the new NICE guidelines for atrial fibrillation, which says, don't use aspirin on its own, just for people with stroke. And of course, everybody's brain says, that can't possibly be true, because I've used aspirin for years for that indication, and isn't it hard? So we might want to think about prologue number three, which is Joan. How many people do see patients? Hands up. Okay, so the rest of you will have to imagine that you see patients. So Joan's 84. She's had a couple of heart attacks. She's had well-controlled heart failure. She's at the sort of far end of the survival curve. She's a survivor with heart failure. She's had heart failure for about 8 years now and is still pretty much symptom-free. We think she's got osteoporosis because she's had a couple of low-impact fractures. She's fractured her hip and she's broken her wrist. She gets bouts of gout occasionally, and her renal function isn't great. But then nobody's renal function is greater 84. Her EGFR runs in the sort of mid-20s. There's a list of medicines here, and she now has a new problem. She's developed atrial fibrillation. Her risk for stroke is certainly getting towards the top end. For the technical people here, the CHA2DS2 score I've calculated for you is 5. And her risk of bleeding is 3. So what do you think we should do for Joan, those of you who do this? What's the thing that you'd want to cover in this consultation? It's a stroke thing, isn't it, really? Atrial fibrillation increases your risk of having a stroke phenomenally. If you have a stroke due to atrial fibrillation, a bit of clot forms in the heart and flies up through the bloodstream to the brain. And it's a really serious, horrible thing to happen and potentially preventable by anticoagulation. Yeah? So I do this in a workshop of clinicians, and I say, okay, you might want to discuss these sorts of numbers with Joan. So if there's 1,000 people like Joan, how many will have a stroke in the next year? If there's 1,000 people like Joan, how many will have a major bleed in the next year? Because if we anticoagulate her risk of having a complication, a bleeding from the gut or perhaps into the back of the eye or somewhere else goes up because we've, in effect, thinned the blood. And how do those numbers change if Joan is anticoagulated? Anybody want to have a guess? If there's 1,000 people like Joan, how many will have a stroke in the next year? So people with a CHA2DS2VASc score of 5. 50? Yeah. Anybody else? I've done this in workshops with loads more clinicians. The numbers that people estimate range from 1 to 100. I've done it with the staff from a stroke unit, a regional stroke unit, and their numbers went as high as 2 to 300. Interestingly, if you see lots of strokes, you think the risk is much higher than if you don't see lots of people with strokes. But it would be good to actually know those numbers and to be able to have a conversation with her about the risks and benefits and the options. But it would be good if we knew pretty closely what those numbers were, but we don't really need to. So that's three things. We have to work out what the evidence is, find it and apply it to people like Joan, not just create it into guidelines. And then we have to work out why is it that we find it so hard to change clinical practice, to make different decisions from the ones that we're used to making. Yeah, that's setting it up. Everybody okay? So this is where you need your piece of paper and a pen. Everybody ready? A list of words follows. Look at them once, but don't reread them. When you've read the list, close your eyes. Nothing horrible happens. There's no gunk tank in the ceiling. The closing the eyes is just a signal for me, so I know we can move on to the next bit. Everybody okay? When you've read the list, close your eyes. Pretty much everybody there. Write down as many words as you can remember. Come on, we've got some of the most intelligent life forms on the planet. Come on. Anybody need more time to copy from their neighbour? So who's got 20 words? Okay. Boorish? 3, 4, 5? That's the norm. Anybody think they're doing quite well compared to the peer group? 7, 8? Yeah, 1 or 2? Okay. Just take a look, everybody, at the list again. Just take a look and see if any of you have misremembered a word. Hands up if you've misremembered a word straight off. Yeah, it's quite. Now that's interesting, isn't it? How easy it is to mix things up. Second thing, how many people are A's and B's people, predominantly remembering words from the start of the list? How many people are D's and E's people, predominantly remembering words from the back end of the list? And how many people are all over the place and no true pattern? Okay, it splits out. If you have a big enough sample, it's about a third, and a third. So that's interesting as well. You have an inbuilt propensity for remembering things from the start of something or from the end of something or scattered all over. But the whole point of this is that nobody can remember everything. Your cognitive ability is bounded. It's not infinite. And if you think that this is a bit harsh, those of you who do clinical work, yeah, the list of potential drugs that interact with warfarin runs to 4 slides. I've not put it up. I'm not going to ask you to write it down. But somehow clinicians find their way through this, and we don't get as many complications from this sort of stuff as you would think, although warfarin sits up there as one of the top causes of iatrogenic admission to hospital, admission caused by taking a medicine or something caused by something that's being done to them. So that's the first thing. Who's bought a car in the last 3 years? Okay, since you're close to me, tell us what you did to help you make a decision for buying a car.
Well, actually it was my husband that bought a car.
Okay.
He didn't do his homework anywhere near enough. So what I did, after he'd already paid for the car evidently, he bought it while I was overseas.
Okay.
So I went onto all the other car websites.
Yes.
Look at the cars, how many kilometres they had, how old they were.
Okay.
What sort of safety features.
So this would be a summary sort of website. What car website or a
car sales, it's called in Australia.
Okay, yeah, same sort of thing, I think.
Then I went to the choice, it's the RACV in our country.
Okay.
And they give you what's the safest car, prices you should be paying.
Okay.
Then I looked at the insurance, how much you should pay for that.
Okay.
And it was all too late because he'd already bought the car.
Okay. I've not had that one before. Somebody else? Who else wants to tell us about what they did about buying a car? Go for it. Let's come over here. We won't go to spend all night because we want to get to other stuff as well. But please tell us. It's on.
I used Auto Trader.
Okay.
Set the filters to what I wanted. What type of engine, what size engine, what type of fuel, what type of transmission.
Yeah. How did you, just let me interrupt you for a minute.
How far away it was from Oxford.
How did you decide what variables you were going to put in? So you were looking at price and safety. How did you decide on those things? Because you obviously made the same choice around the things.
Based on my experience with my previous two cars, I was looking for something no fuel consumption, no similar.
Yeah.
Same car, a few years younger.
Okay.
I had an idea of how old it would be.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Did you do anything else in terms of helping you make a choice?
No, I pretty much set all the choices were there for me to set on the filters.
Out comes the results, and that's not too far away. I'll go and look at that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. Thank you very much. That's pretty typical. We select a few things that are important to us: size, cost, colour, various bits, safety, fuel consumption is a common one. I've never had anybody say they went to the Society of Automotive Engineers website and read the systematic review on engine testing, theory and practice, third edition, 700 pages, you made a perfectly good decision without ploughing through the technical engineering jargon. People don't go for laminated glass, design considerations for vehicle door systems, fast track, the 40-minute PowerPoint presentation. We truncate stuff, we make quicker decisions, we don't go to these detailed things, and arguably it wouldn't have helped you to make a better, quicker, easier, safer decision about which car to buy if you had read 700 pages on mechanical engineering about car engines. You see my point? We can get by without the 700 pages. So Herbert Simon won the Nobel Prize for describing the fact that your rationality is bounded, that it is simply not possible for you to read, learn, hear, learn, see, learn, store it away, recall it in context, just at the point at which you might need it. Most of the time, you make a good enough decision, you collect sufficient information to reduce your uncertainty to the point at which you're able to make a decision. That's an important phrase. So you're looking to reduce uncertainty to the point at which you're able to decision. And once you reach that point, you can stop and make a decision. It's called satisficing. And if you do this work with general practitioners, they can get through the week with Satisfy saying, for every problem that they face, barring one or two. And then they do the alternative. They temporise, they'll do some investigations, they'll say we'll give it a few days, and then they'll go away and they'll do some more information collecting. That's called maximising. That might be from other people, it might be from the internet these days. In times past, it might have been from books. So Satisfying is the normal way we go about making decisions. Maximising is a rare approach. And this Herbert Simon work is counter to the notion that all we need to do to make better decisions is to have all of the information. And that's palpably not true. And it has implications for fields of artificial intelligence, which was part of Herbert Simon's work, but we don't need to go there now. If you look at how this blends into clinical practice, this is a quick bit of work published in The Lancet by a couple of junior doctors who looked at the patients that they'd admitted under their care in the previous 24 hours on call. So it was 18 patients with 44 diagnoses. So lots of them were like Joan, with more than one thing wrong with them. They calculated that if they were to set out to read the relevant guidelines pertinent to those 44 diagnoses published only in the last 3 years in the UK, just by relevant Royal Colleges and NICE, they would have to read 3,679 pages. And at 2 minutes reading each page, the physician on call would need to read for 122 hours. So there's a different way of getting through this. This is not simply more knowledge equals easier decision making. There's clearly something going on, as you saw with the diclofenac stuff. When we do John Gabay and Andre LeMay's Mindline stuff, and those of you who've been on the course this week will have heard about Mindlines already, I think, from about a systematic review. This is the quote that I like to put up. Clinicians rarely access appraise and use explicit evidence directly from research or other formal sources. Rare exceptions are where they need to go and maximise. Gabby and LeMay didn't write that, but that's what they meant. Instead, they rely on what we call mind lines. So in contrast to guidelines, mind lines, patterns, pictures in our heads. These are collectively reinforced, internalised, tacit, so not necessarily written down anywhere. Guidelines informed by brief reading. Think about where you got your information from your cars. Brief reading, but mainly their interactions with each other and with opinion leaders, patients, pharmaceutical reps, and other sources of largely tacit knowledge that builds on early training. So patterns are ingrained, and then we use the patterns. And that leads me on to the fact that simply constructing guidelines isn't enough. There's clearly a community of practice involved in Mindlines before we get to the consultation with Joan and the individual bits and the complexity of all of this. Three different translations, they all require different methodologies. We've worked on that one, not too much on the other two. So, second theory, we've done bounded rationality. It's great being a professor of evidence-informed decision-making. There's only two things you need to know. One is bounded rationality. The second is dual process theory. Who knows the story of Noah in the Bible? Come on, don't be shy. I saw you twitch. Just prepare the brain now. Tell us briefly the story of Noah in the Bible.
Well, as I remember it, something to do with people have been misbehaving generally.
Yep.
Noah had been well behaved, and therefore God said to him, build an ark.
Yeah.
Take all the animals on board.
Yeah.
You'll be safe.
Yeah.
Everyone else died.
Yeah. And the raven went out without a thing in his mouth.
So, yeah, sometime later.
Yeah.
40 days and 40 nights.
Yeah.
The world had been flooded, and then, yes, he sent out some birds, raven initially.
And then a dove, and the dove comes back
dove
with...
comes back with some, what was it?
An olive branch.
Olive branch, that's
yeah.
Right, hence the olive branch.
Yeah.
And that was the signal that the flood was receding.
Yeah. Everybody happy? Everybody remember the story of Noah now?
And it was done by Russell Crowe recently as well.
Ah, yeah, Russell Crowe and Jim Carrey. Do you remember the Jim Carrey film? Yeah, two of every kind. Oh, yeah, okay. Imagine you're working as a doctor in a remote village. It's the weekend. There's no other healthcare professionals around, but you do have a new piece of technology called the Marveltron. The Marveltron will save the life of any patient you're treating, but you have to answer correctly the question the Marveltron asks of the attending doctor before it works its magic. A young child is brought to you. She is seriously ill and it appears she'll die imminently. You switch on the Marveltron and await the question. Now you must write down your answer immediately the question is asked or the child will die. Pen and paper ready? Importantly, you'll get no blame if you get the answer to this question wrong. You'll only be blamed if you don't try and save the life. This is the Good Samaritan as well as the Noah story. So are you ready? Didn't work. According to the Bible, how many giraffes did Noah take into the ark? Answer quickly, write it down, child is dying, end of answer period. Let's cut to the chase because time's getting on. How many people wrote down two? Yeah, pretty much everybody wrote down two. So where did you get that evidence from? A Bible story. Somebody told it to you once a long time ago. Anybody else? Where did you get it from?
Probably assumed it since it may not have mentioned giraffes, but it said all the animals you talk about Tuesday, it was an assumption.
Yeah. Okay, so we just know it, don't we? It's in there. Somehow we know the animals go in two by two. There's even a Disney song. Yeah? Let's check with the guideline. Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and the female. And of beasts that are not clean by two. So are giraffes a clean beast? Clean beasts have cloven hooves and chew the cud. Here is the cloven hoof of a giraffe. Here is the cloven hoof on the desert floor. Here is the YouTube video of giraffes chewing their cud. The correct answer is 14, not two. 14, not two. And at this point, somebody's going to get their iPhone out and start Googling Bible.com. Because your brain is saying, that can't possibly be true. I know that the animals go in two by two. The pattern is imprinted with you. I promise you. The answer is 14. I've even had an Orthodox Jewish pharmacist get out his iPhone and Google the Torah in Hebrew. And he teaches this in the synagogue. And after about 5 minutes, he said, gosh, Neil, you're right. Even in the Torah, it's 14. And I've been telling everybody it's two by two. Okay, the point is, once we know something, which once we've had it imprinted several times, it sticks with us and it's really hard to do something different. Pattern recognition is actually part of our DNA. We're all descended from about 5,000 ancestors living in Eastern Africa millions of years ago, and their pattern recognition had a survival advantage. If you could recognize a berry that you could eat, from one that would poison you, a friend from a foe, an animal that you could chase and catch and eat, from one that would chase and catch and eat you, there was a survival advantage. And as I'll demonstrate shortly, this pattern recognition is so strong in us that we can't actually turn it off. So once we've started prescribing diclofenac, it's really difficult to stop it. In fact, once we have a pattern of behavior in our minds, it's terribly easy just to go along, and it's actually an advantage. So I was in Amsterdam last week. I'm staying at a hotel that I've never stayed at before. I don't know how to find my way through the transport system. Very difficult. Once I've done it once, second time, easy. Classic example of how easy we can get patterns. And this is sort of being constructed together into this dual process theory. So in medicine, if a patient presents, and the pattern processor function that we have, it's not an anatomical site within the brain, it's just the way the brain works. If we've seen it before and we recognise what it is, this is fast, intuitive, we can't switch it off, we don't have to think about it, it just happens, and we can come up with the diagnosis based upon pattern recognition. If you're an undergraduate training or you're a GP trainee, or this is an unusual condition that you've never seen before, then you don't recognise what it is. This type 2 decision-making process requires effort. It's uncomfortable. It takes time, and it's a struggle. And some days, every surgery runs like this, and it feels like a dream. And some days, every surgery runs like this, and it's like walking through treacle. Sometimes, new information comes in, and it will rationally override the first impression we have. Sometimes, despite new information being available, the previous patterns that were imprinted disrationally override the new information that comes in. Think of the MHRA warning about NSAIDs. It's not that people are lazy or unintelligent. They happen to be human beings and they find it difficult to shift patterns. Okay, so we'll do a bit of this in a second. It's actually dual-dual process theory. So in an emergency situation, a trained clinician recognises what the emergency is and provides the life-saving treatment straight away. Fast, quick, life-saving treatment, and don't think that system 2 is always going to be better than system 1. Optimal decision making is actually pattern recognition with a few stop and start rules, some alternatives to just going with the pattern that's there. Gerd Gigerenz has done lots of work on this from Berlin, but I'm skating over the academia. So let's do a bit of this together. All together, big breath in, I want to hear you. Big breath in, what's the answer to this sum? Oh, that was useless. We'll do it again. Big breath in, what's the answer to this sum?
Four.
Thank you, that's better. Okay, so when I put that up the first time, you didn't have to count up on your fingers. I didn't see anybody getting their socks off. It was known to you. The answer was 4. Before you came in here, and it's still 4 now. I promise you, it hasn't changed. 2 and 2 is still 4. All together, big breath in. What's the answer to this sum? Okay. So that requires system 2 processing of a fairly simple nature. But there are some rules of thumb that would help you make a more rapid decision. So if we said that was about 80 and that was about 60, 80 times 60 is about 4,800. So if I was trying to tell you that the answer was 10,000, you'd be able to fairly quickly tell me that I was wrong, providing you knew the rules of thumb, which in this language are called heuristics. So if you know the tricks, you can get there. That's what I mean about stop-start, rules of thumb type stuff. Okay, so what's this? Make the diagnosis here. Big breath in. Everybody recognised Margaret Thatcher. So if you're a clinician and a Margaret Thatcher walked into your consulting room, you'd be able to recognise Margaret Thatcher, yeah? So how many people have met Margaret Thatcher? So this is a pattern recognition. Just Trish, of course. You have the pattern recognition, it's imprinted on you, you've only seen pictures in papers, in magazines, on the television. Most of those pictures were a long time ago. The funeral was a few years ago back, but she was Prime Minister actually, you know, 1990 was when she left office, and yet our pattern recognition as human beings is so brilliant that there is no problem in recognising Margaret Thatcher. We take it for granted, actually, don't we, that we can do that. It's an amazing skill. And if you don't see a distant relative for 10 years, but you happen to come across them at a wedding or a funeral or a christening, you straight away recognise Auntie Minnie, probably from just the way she walks rather than the fact that you've seen her face. It's a fantastic bit of human skill to be able to do that pattern recognition. So if I put this up in front of trained clinicians, they'll say it's straight away. You don't have to go away and work it out. You know that this is shingles. Put it up in front of first year medical students, pharmacy students, nursing students, anybody. Really hard to get to grips with. Don't, no idea what it is, unless they've seen it before in a relative. What emergency treatment does this seriously ill adolescent need, clinicians? Okay, so this is, that's that dual process theory. You've just saved a life, potentially. This is meningococcal septicemia, antibiotics into this seriously ill child as soon as you can, please, and lots of other stuff as well. You don't need to go to the books and start working out what this is or Googling what this might be. We know it straight away, and it's extremely useful pattern recognition. What's this? Okay, I'll take you back to medical school. I'll become the professor of cowology. I spent 20 years recognizing, treating, investigating, researching that rare but serious condition where a human being has turned into a cow. Note carefully, students, the brow, the eyes, the jawline, the nostrils, the ears, and we do lots of stuff in lecture theatres and in small group learning, and I'd set you some tasks to go and do self-directed learning, and then I'd take you onto the ward at the John Radcliffe where a patient had been admitted the previous night under my care, and you'd say, what a great teacher that prof is, because the patient in the bed looks like this, just like the one we learnt about over at the medical school. Note carefully, students, I would say, the brow, the eyes, the jawline, the nostrils, the ears. And we do a bit of additional work, and we might see two or three patients, and I might set the odd test, and then we'd come to your final examination, and I'd set you the task of differential diagnosis. And provided you could correctly identify the patient that's turned into a cow, despite it being a slightly unusual setting, I might let you go off and be a doctor. And there'd be some point to this, because a couple of years later, you'd be working in the A&E department, and a patient comes in looking a bit like this. And you'd have a look at the patient in the cubicle in the accident and emergency department, and you'd sort of squint your eyes a bit, and something might pop up into your brain if you were lucky, and you might go and talk to the registrar and the consultant and say, that chap over there in that cubicle, I think he might have turned into a cow. And you'd be right. And your self-confidence would go up, and your esteem amongst your colleagues would increase. And you'd progress through your career, and then a couple of years later, somebody comes in looking like this. And gradually, if you keep looking at this person in the cubicle, you might spot that that's an ear, and that's an eye, and that's a jawline, and nostrils, another ear here. Now I've got it. Is everybody seeing the cow on the screen? Okay. That's how fast the brain can start to recognize patterns. Importantly, look at the screen and close your eyes. Now open them again. Now try not to see the cow. Because now it's imprinted. So if I wanted to get you to write out a prescription for a new drug, I'd get you to try it out two or three times. Once you've written it out three times, you'll write it out again for the fourth patient and the fifth patient, no problem whatsoever. The printing happens that quickly. So this is how it works in terms of education, since we're in an educational centre. If I asked you to drive me home to the northwest of England tonight and you'd never driven a car before, I hope you'd say no. Because you're consciously incompetent. You know you can't drive a car because you've never had a driving lesson. Please say no. But if you had some driving lessons, it would be hard. You'd have to put some effort in. It would be system two. It would be slow. But by the time you got to your driving test, providing you thought about what you were doing whilst you were doing the driving test, you might just be consciously competent. Now, after lots of practice at driving, system two has gone into system one with repetition, and you can drive a car now whilst working out the shopping list and thinking about what's happening with the kids and what's gone on at work today and all of those sorts of things. I wasn't thinking coming here today, now it's time to change gear, now I need to press the clutch, etc. Yeah? The problem is that sometimes things change, somebody steps out in front of you, or the lights alter, or the road differs, you're using your system one, at that point you're unconsciously incompetent, you think you're okay but you're not. And if this is a situation that needs repetition, you have to assess that, become aware of it. Yet that requires effort. Just recognizing you need to change requires effort. And then you have to go back and learn again to write ibuprofen and naproxen, not diclofenac. And that's hard because it requires effort. What goes wrong with this pattern recognition? Steve is shy and withdrawn, invariably helpful, but with little interest in people. He has a need for order and structure and a passion for detail. Which of these is it most likely that Steve is? What do you think? Librarian pharmacist, yeah? Librarian pharmacist is what most people are saying. I know quite a lot of librarians. I know even more pharmacists. I agree with you. How did you reach that conclusion, though? Yeah, you created a picture. From the text up here, you don't need a picture. You can create pictures that easily by just reading some text. And then you apply this picture to the alternatives that are down here and see the one that matches most. This is a cognitive bias. It's called base rate neglect. Because in most countries, in most populations, the numbers of farmers are much greater than any of these options. So even if a small proportion of farmers had these introverted traits, it's still more likely on the numbers that Steve's a farmer than any of these. The pattern recognition led you astray. And there's more than 100 of these. So anchoring bias, an early salient feature in a consultation is something that a clinician might fix on, and despite continuing cues emerging throughout that consultation, they stick with the first impression that comes to mind. Ascertainment bias, thinking shaped by prior expectations. So I'm a GP in Scarborough. Years ago, I was on call. It's 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday morning. The nightclubs are turning out. That's quite early for these days, isn't it? But the nightclubs were turning out at 3 a.m. And there's a guy staggers across the pavement, trips at the side of the gutter and falls in the road, and I very nearly run him over. What's the diagnosis? He's drunk. Yeah, he'd actually had a stroke. But I thought, because of where I was and where he was, time of day, I thought he was drunk too. Recent experience dominates the evidence. So if you're a doctor and you've prescribed an evidence-based treatment for a patient and it's not something you're familiar with, the patient develops a horrible side effect, how hard is it to then write out the prescription for the next patient for whom it's indicated? Yeah? Recent experience dominates what the evidence says. So it's just pattern recognition all the time. I won't run through all of these. Let me go with this one, the gambler's fallacy. So I've seen three people recently with chest pain just in the last couple of weeks. They've all had heart attacks. I would normally say, you know, two or three of these a year at most. Here's a fourth patient with crushing central chest pain going down their arm. They're sweating and they're feeling sick. My brain is saying this can't possibly be a fourth person with a heart attack in 2 weeks. That just can't be the case. Whereas, of course, if I stand back and think about it, the presentation of this patient now cannot possibly be connected with the three other patients who've had heart attacks in the last 2 weeks. There can be no connection whatsoever. It can't just be luck. Search satisfying. So the most commonly missed fracture on an X-ray in the A&E department is? Scaphoid, no. Colles, no. Nope. The most commonly missed fracture is the second fracture. Because you look on the x-ray of whatever's hurting, you see a fracture and you say, great, I found out why this patient's hurting. And that can have serious consequences if they've got four fractures in a hand, because that needs the hand surgeon now, because that's an occupationally threatening set of conditions, whereas a crack in one metacarpal is probably a back slap and see you in fracture clinic on Monday. Completely different situation. So lots of these cognitive biases, they all have a basis in pattern recognition. I know what it is, and I'll recognise that. Who's this? Jesus, straight away. Just everybody, yeah? Jesus? Yeah. Representation of Jesus. Nobody's really sure what Jesus looks like, of course, but traditionally, this could be Jesus, yeah? Okay. Not Jesus. This is a piece of toast. But the pattern makes you think of Jesus. Jesus in the Kit Kat bar? Got that one before? Be careful eating Kit Kat bars when you're driving a car. I'm not sure this is a true story. I got it from the internet. But it just fitted very nicely, so I put it in. Who's this? Not Hitler. But doesn't it make you think of Hitler? It's this pattern recognition thing. Once it starts, you can't turn it off. Once you've got the pattern there, it's really hard. You have to make a conscious effort not to go with saying, gosh, that cat looks like Hitler. Which it does, of course. You can see the problem. Oh, we've got some repetition. So lots of cognitive biases. This slide's put in to remind me to mention affective biases. So the airline pilots talk about being hungry, angry, late, or tired. Tired is the connotation here. I don't necessarily read right across from things in the aviation industry to the decision-making in medicine, but I think there is something we could learn from the awareness pilots have, self-awareness, that they need to be particularly careful if they've got one of those. Certainly as a GP for 20 years, I'd have all four of those most days. And that certainly seems to be true the way things are in clinical medicine at the moment. Affective biases, any one of them individually increases your chances of making an error by 30%. We don't make too many errors, fortunately. But a relative increase of 30% is worth thinking about. So let's go back to Joan as we finish off now. What would be the optimum consultation with Joan? We'd want to know something about the benefits and risks of anticoagulation. And when I was at NICE, I actually did some work with a colleague called Andy Hutchinson, and actually we ran the world championships of atrial fibrillation experts and shared decision-making experts and came up with this sort of graphic. So at the top, there's 1,000 people like Joan. And over the next 12 months, 916 people won't have a stroke, but 84 people will. So you weren't too far away with 50. It's a ballpark figure, it's not too far away. That's just the point estimate. It'll have confidence intervals around it. It's not necessarily absolutely accurate to four decimal places, but that's the sort of ballpark figure we could come up with from the best available evidence at the time. So how do you represent that to Joan if you get into the conversation with her about her risks of stroke? Do you say, great news, Joan, if there's 1,000 people like you, over the next year, 1,000 people won't have a stroke related to, 916 people out of 1,000 won't have a stroke related to the atrial fibrillation, but 84 people will? Or do you say, bad news, Joan, this atrial fibrillation, 84 people out of 1,000 will have a stroke in the next year, but 916 won't? Because how you frame that news and those numbers will make a big difference to how she views it, and actually to the way you view it. And you'll have a propensity for one way round or the other, and you shouldn't, because you're trying to reach an unbiased decision, you and Joan. Because you have a mind line about this, but Joan has a mind line about this too. And we don't know what Joan's is yet. If we add in the anticoagulation, 57 people are saved from having an atrial fibrillation related stroke if we anticoagulate all 1,000. All 1,000 have to take the anticoagulation, only 57 are helped. And again, there's the framing problem with the how much benefit people get as well. And then there's the problem that you don't have a crystal ball. You can only say to Joan what will happen in the population. You can't say what will happen for her. As Phil Hammond said years ago, having a stethoscope is no substitute for a crystal ball. It would be great if you could say what would happen to her, but you can't. In terms of bleeding, there's 9 people who have a bleed without anticoagulation, and it goes up by another 15. Most people don't have bleeds, but nevertheless, that's a significant increase. So does that solve the problem for you? Now you know the evidence. Does that help you to make the decision for Joan? I would argue not. Because you can't tell what will happen to her, and you don't know how she feels about this, and you've no idea what else is going on in her head. So Attlegar one day of Reith Letcher's fame and Beer Mortal fame, I would recommend reading anything about Attlegar one day, but particularly Being Mortal. And he says there's probably 4 questions we need to ask a bit more often. What's your understanding of your illness? What are your fears and worries for the future? What outcomes would be unacceptable to you? And what are we trying to do here? What are we trying to do for you? In American speak, it's what are the goals of care if time is short? And I can't do accents, as you've just discovered. I don't think I'd do the if time is short, because most 84-year-olds know that time is short and don't need their noses rubbing in it. Yeah? But something along those lines would perhaps be worth exploring. There's an evidence base for this. This is a randomised controlled trial of using those sorts of questions to people who've got widespread lung cancer at diagnosis. So the randomisation is to having that sort of conversation and not having that sort of conversation. The people who had that conversation had 20% fewer emergency admissions for hospice or hospital care. Their costs were 20 to 30% lower. The costs of care were 20 to 30% lower. They lived, on average, 25% longer. And interestingly, of those who died, they looked at the relatives of the people who died, and the people who'd had that advanced planning conversation, the relatives of those people were in much better shape 6 months after death of their beloved relative. This is the randomised controlled trial at the end of a GP consultation saying, is there anything else we can usefully talk about today? Or is there something else we could usefully talk about today? Anything or something? Something gets you 80% of the hidden agendas. It gets you where Joan is with this stuff. If you say anything, it seems to close it off. One word. It's incredibly powerful, and we've not explored how to do this fantastically well as an individual. So, how did it go with Joan, do you think? Well, we started off with the anticoagulation stroke reduction type of conversation, but we didn't get too far. I don't want any more tablets. I feel ill all the time. I'm unsteady on my feet. I need help with shopping. I need help getting in and out of the shower in the morning. She's frightened of falling over and fracturing her hip again, which is a fairly unpleasant experience. At the moment, I can't stand and cook, and she was a great cook, really keen on cooking, as you can see. How am I going to get a meal? But we persisted. I don't want warfarin. My husband was on warfarin, it was awful. I'm not interested in your pictures of benefits and risks. I'm 84 now. Tell me which of my tablets are controlling my symptoms and let's stop the rest. I'll take my chances. Never mind that the guideline says anticoagulate people who are at risk of stroke because they've got atrial fibrillation, you'll prevent lots of strokes. At the population level, it works fantastically. At the individual level, it may well not. And we've concentrated on the population, not the individual. So what happened? Joan did well. She didn't take her anticoagulant. Some of her medicines were stopped. She didn't have a stroke because the odds were always on in favour of her not having a stroke. Many more green faces than red faces. She got stronger. She was able to look after herself and her own flat with little support. 5 more years of good quality of life and died peacefully 2 months short of her 89th birthday. I'm well qualified to tell you Joan's story. Joan was actually my mum. And you can see the effect of cardiac cachexia, long-standing end-stage heart disease. Her ankles are swollen, but this is 12:45 in the morning at a party. And I'm saying, Mum, it's 12:45. Shall I take you home? You're going to be ever so tired tomorrow. And she was saying, you must be joking. How often do I get to come to a party like this? Take me over there. I haven't seen Mary for ages. That sort of stuff. So the epilogue, very quickly, 4 slides. Patient-centeredness, I think, now is an absolute given. Every consultation, values and preferences of patients has got to be there. And whilst we've done some work on consultation skills, most specialists get nothing. GPs get some process-based stuff, and it's still nowhere near enough to get to that wonderful expertise that's required to do these sorts of preference-sensitive consultations really well. The bifocal vision, I think, is a really useful concept. So we're not ditching the evidence. We want to know what the evidence is for the population. It's essential both for Joan and for her clinician to know what that evidence is, perhaps in some circumstances. But sometimes people make decisions without knowing what the evidence is. They'll just go with a few variables and just make a choice based on, well, that was quite good, we'll do that again, as we did with the cars. So we have to have a focus on the individual and a focus on the population, both of these, not predominantly this, which EBM has done more of for the last 20 years, I think. Third thing, I think we're all agreed the evidence doesn't make the decision for you. Decision making is an entity on its own, and we have to know the evidence, but we have to be really good at making decisions too, and knowing a bit about what's going on in our heads and knowing a bit about what might be going on in the patient's heads, and exploring the two together might be somewhat better than everybody gets aspirin after a heart attack, let's say. So the final slide is the sort of where we're going to need to go with this. We need to do a bit more on the curriculum. We need to help people find the stuff that really matters. We need to understand ourselves. So we need to understand pattern recognition and bounded rationality and how those two things work together for us and how we can employ those heuristics, those stop-start rules, because we will inevitably make most decisions using system one and pattern recognition. And then the final bit is let's work a bit more at the consultation skills in order to have really great, meaningful consultations with people. That's the sort of curriculum that we need to be heading for. And it's a spiral curriculum. It's no good talking to medical students about decision making because they're still constructing nodes of knowledge. Once you start having to make decisions, you need to know a bit about making decisions. But before that time, it's too soon. But an awareness that this is where you're heading and we're expecting you to become an expert might be really helpful. I hope that's been helpful. Thank you very much for the invitation.